This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Welcome to What's News Dunedin, brought to you by Casa Valencia, the radio show that spawned from the 23,000 plus strong local Otipoti Dunedin What's News Dunedin Facebook group. The group that's been putting the social back in the social media since 2020 with respectful adult debate and a sense of humour. I'm your host, Richard Knights. On today's show, we're talking to our wonderful guest, Ala Suka, a former refugee, who'll be telling us a bit more about themselves and what they do, as well as helping us look back at the posts that have generated the most interactions over the past 7 days on the What's News Dunedin Facebook group. Those posts this week are the extremely disappointing news that New Zealand First are trying to bring back their bigoted attempts to legally define men and women. The Hawke's Bay Mayor declaring a state of emergency in relation to recent severe weather events in the North Island, woke, and the continued war in the Middle East. Welcome to the show, Ala.
Thank you very much, Richard, for having me.
Awesome. Now, before we do all that, we're going to have our pun of the week, right? So we have a Punday Monday post in the group, which basically is we bring our best dad jokes, puns, and what we try and do is see if whoever gets the most laugh reacts. So this is no science involved here whatsoever. Whoever gets the most laugh reacts on Monday gets to have their joke read out on the show on Friday. So we're going to see if you find this funny. And there's no requirement to find it funny. I should set that scene very early on, right? It's Andrew Perkins is one of our regular contributors on the Punday Monday. If you don't find the joke funny, don't laugh. Okay, so but if you do, obviously give him a giggle. That's what. So, pun of the week: how can you tell when a clock is hungry? It goes back 4 seconds.
Not bad.
No, exactly. It's like one of the things that goes back for a sec. I get it. It's good. So that's a thumbs up for Andrew. Well done. Thank you for contributing. And everyone listening, please bring your puns next Monday and we'll see whether they come to the show on Friday. Now, before we even get started on the news, we've got what I call my three pop questions. All right. So these are just three questions that, in my wisdom, I've thought up. And I think that they get under the skin of my guests to let everyone listening know exactly what you as a person, you know, the deep diving questions, right? They're just fun. So first question, cream teas. So you have if you're not aware of cream tea, you have a scone, you have jam, you have cream. What goes on the scone first, the jam or the cream?
Personally, I will put the jam first.
That is the right answer. You don't have to go any further than that, Ala. It's because where I come from, it's a highly debated thing, okay? Probably not so much in Syria or where you come from and not so much here, but where I come from in the UK, there's two counties right next to each other, Devonshire cream tea, Cornish cream tea, right? And they do it the opposite way. So Devon puts the jam on second, which is really weird. Cornwall does it the right way because it's science, right? Jam, you can't spread cream on jam. You can spread cream on jam, you can't spread jam on cream, right? So it makes sense to do it that way. The Cornish people have got it right. Devon, not so much, right?
It's not bad. It's more, it's comfy food. So comfortable food, eat it the way you feel comfortable.
Oh, absolutely. But do it right. Like be comfortable. But in my mind, you've got to, that one you've got to do right.
Less miss.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So now, that's the only question you can get wrong on my show. So now you've got that right. Everything is thumbs up from this point forward, right? Second question is, who is your favorite Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle?
To be honest, it's a bit tricky. Raffaello?
Oh, there's no wrong answers with the turtles, mate. No wrong answers at all. All named after Renaissance painters, Leonardo, Raphael, Michelangelo and Donatello. You could have Master Splinter. Someone said April, the journalist. They're all valid answers in the realm of the turtles, right? So it's cowabunga, dudes. These are, you know, that is absolutely fine. Now, the third question is a thinker. So this is the one where you might have to stop for a second and think. You know, it's one of those would you rathers. So would you rather wear wet socks for an entire year or have sweaty armpits all the time?
I will go with the sweaty armpits.
Sweaty armpits?
Yeah, I cannot feel like wet toes feel
it's,
weird.
Wet socks is horrid, eh? Yeah. It's like one of those ones. I did a lot of tramping and mountain walking and stuff as a young lad. And if you got your feet wet, that was just the worst. That was it. You just kind of going like, my boots, my feet, my socks are slopping around. It's just, yeah, I think I'd probably go sweaty armpits too.
Me too.
Yeah, so like, don't come near me, I want to smell, but like, but at least my socks are dry.
Yeah,
absolutely. No, I'm with you on that one. So, want to go back now and talk about the three topics of the week. So these are the topics that have created the most noise on the What's News Dunedin Facebook group. And the first one was the first one is a real bugbear of mine. The first one was the disappointing news that New Zealand First have been trying to bring back the legislation or bring forward legislation to legally define men and women. Right now, in my mind, not everyone's mind, like. I don't care how people choose to identify. If you want to identify as a woman, that's totally fine. I've got trans family, whānau. I've got rainbow whānau. I'm inclusive and of everyone. Now, the biggest problem with the legislation, as I can see it too, is that it doesn't actually help legally. So it's kind of bigoted posturing to kind of smash down on our trans family without actually any kind of credible outcome that benefits anybody else. Like, you know, so once they go through that process, there is actually nothing legally that assists. So it's that kind of minority bashing that there's a certain segment of our population, and there always will be, that just want to be nasty. It feels like nasty, you know. I mean, when you consider that, I think it's 0.7% of New Zealanders identify as something, you know, sort of self-identify in that transgender arena, intersex, non-binary, those kind of things. You're talking about punching down on a tiny proportion of our population. But what you're also doing is you're trying to demonize that segment of our population when there's 99% of men and women. You know, if you want to use the New Zealand First definition of it, men and women, that are far more dangerous to the people bringing this legislation or trying to bring this legislation than the people they're trying to demonize.
Yep. I would say personally, I totally agree it's a very hard topic for and causing a lot of it's a sensitive topic for a lot of vulnerable people as well to talk about it. But personally, to be honest, I would say that it's more a distraction thing. Whenever you see part of the social engineering aspect in most states utilized is that whenever more common ground created among people, and currently it's the crisis of living, petrol prices, everything that people are facing, the most common, all ordinary New Zealanders are facing currently, you need a divide. You need to distract them from their common ground and go back to their differences. And usually the differences is very minor. Because as you said, whatever the outcome of that thing is not helping your everyday life.
No.
Currently it's actually causing more issues, could cause more harm for people in some situations. But we need to look at more the common ground because most Kiwis want to live their life, achieve what they want to hope, live in dignity and make ends meet.
Yeah, and that's the other side of it. Like for the vast, vast majority of the 99% that I'm talking about that don't identify in that trans whānau, most of us just want to get on and just do our thing. You know, most of us don't give that a second thought. It's a tiny minority in the 99% that are somehow feel endangered or affected by things that haven't happened. It's like every time something like that comes on the page, right? And I've had this experience this week, right? Someone comes and asks me, they always come and ask me, so define a woman, define this, define that, you know. And I said, a woman is someone that identifies themselves as a woman, right? I firmly believe our trans women are women, right? That's my view, right? I said, so why are you so interested in how someone else chooses to try and get on and live their life? Like no one chooses to be trans for an easy life. Right, no one, because the nastiness that they face is revolting. But because I made that answer, someone, and we don't name and shame ever on the group, someone went out and made a nasty, racist, homophobic, transphobic meme of me and started trying to share that around social media about me, you know, because I stood up for our 1%. And I find that crazy, all right? Because I'm not a threat to anyone. They're not a threat to anyone. Yeah. What is it that's got those people so scared that they have to try and gather support, you know, like, you know, muscle around them in order to attack me for that. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Unfortunately, it's a lot of social media. It's that echoes what not reality in a lot of times.
Yep.
In the communities. We know a lot of people who was going to comment in a bad situations. Usually, they just want that stir. They want that troll online or try to assassinate the character of a person or something like that. But as I said, like, as you also said, we are not trying to harm any people. We're not. We just want dignity and equality for everyone to live their life, choose what they want to choose, identify yourself the way you feel like it.
Yep.
Don't let someone force you to wear a specific pajama and be like, you're part of that group. Now you should be feeling that way.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to see, but this is unfortunately like a part of the current age we're living in.
Yeah.
The accessible of allowing, the space allows a lot of noise to come up. And unfortunately, in some cases, we know the agorism is actually supporting the hate or the controversial topics more than people are saying, like, oh, let's love each other or let's be one.
I know. I've always found it's a lot easier to be friendly to someone than it is to be nasty to someone. It takes far more energy.
Yeah.
Like, it genuinely does. But there are a certain segment that just live in that kind of perpetual state of, hey, I came across it in the internet the other day, because obviously I spend a lot of time on social media because I'm running a Facebook group, right? But I was in Dunedin News Uncut, and there was one person that was just trying to falsely pretend that they wanted to engage with me, but they just wanted to argue with me. And I kind of politely said, like, I'm not interested. Like, I don't need your aggression. I don't need, you know, but they just wouldn't let it, because they live in that perpetual state of they're going to be fighting someone, which just, again, like, I can't imagine living my day like that. Can you? You imagine getting up in the morning and thinking, I've got to be angry today?
To be honest, I try my best to keep myself in a good positive state of position, like of thinking mindset. I try not to use any energy on those stuff. Because, like, let's be honest, in my personal view and also culture views, it's hate is not opposite of love. The opposite of that is actually, I don't care.
Right.
So I try not to, if someone is just shouting about hate speech, he want to make a win. There is no win in those debates, like, to
yeah.
be honest, we are all human difference. And in my point of view, or the way it came from of my journey, like, I love differences. If I will seeing that, whatever your background, we are actually adding to the community. The more differences in the community, the more background point of views that will rise us and will make us stronger and resilience
yeah.
on all aspect of life, social aspect, economical aspect, all that things, like when we bring different background, different perspective, different journeys. We have also different relationship, different networking overseas. Like, we bring so many things, the differences. So that's why I feel really the strongest community is the most community who can manage to live with all the differences and find the common ground. And as I said, like, the common ground is very, way bigger than the differences.
Oh, absolutely. So let's talk about the Hawke's Bay mayor. Now, we've been having the North Island, particularly in the last kind of 12 months, has been getting absolutely smashed by weather event after weather event after weather event. And I found it hilarious because actually it's the first time in 3 years that I've agreed with Christopher Luxon, which is in itself is crazy. But the Hawke's Bay mayor came out and they wanted to declare a state of emergency, right? We've got these serious events going on. We've got people being displaced from their homes. We've got the potential for flood and for, you know, for people to get seriously injured and die. And the mayor came out and said that declaring a state of emergency was woke, all right? And it reminds me of the meme that you get that does the rounds on social media that was like a little book which says, everything I don't like is woke. And that was it. And you're kind of going, I've been called woke for years, right? I see that as a compliment. It means I care about people. It means I'm in touch with, you know, the social aspects of life. I'm looking at, and I'm empathetic. But no problem with being called woke. But to call declaring a state of emergency woke just seems so completely, like, foolish. And then you've got Christopher Luxon saying, like, hey, I'm happy to, you call me woke if you want for declaring a state of emergency, but our view is here, we've got to protect people.
To be honest, yeah, like, whenever it comes about people's safety, you should not hesitate. Like, sometimes you should do the action and then assist, and specifically in crisis situation. And in general, I've been living in New Zealand so far over almost 10 years now.
Yep.
And my background is actually crisis management, studying it. Mainly economic and political crisis management. What my issue in all systems in New Zealand so far, it's all is functioning at the ambulance in the bottom of the cliff.
Yep.
We saw the crisis coming. We know about it. We have extremely qualified people to do a plan to manage the crisis, but we wait. We wait until it happens. So we have now currently, unfortunately, even like our housing crisis, our when we have housing crisis, it does not happen overnight. It happens. You must flag it 20 years ago.
Yeah, we knew we were going to have a housing crisis, and we did so little about it.
Yeah, and we wait until it became bigger. Unfortunately, that wait, we know that now it's cost us more.
Like, of course.
And it's not only costing us, it's going to cost the future generation way more than it's costing us now, because delaying of a solution to such a big thing, community-related crisis, It's a massive thing. If we didn't do that, we're failing our kids. We're failing our future. We're just shooting ourselves in the foot. Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I was very glad to see Christopher Luxon come out and say it, because actually sometimes this kind of stupidity needs to just be called out. And you're right. We so often are spending our time as the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff rather than trying to build a fence at the top of the cliff, which is what we should be striving for on a daily basis. But for me, when it comes to safety, when it comes to an individual's life or the risk, there is you if you're going to go overboard, that's the time to go overboard. That's the time to do too much, right? And look at it back and go, oh, I probably went a little bit, you know, too hard on that, but at least no one died. Exactly. You know, genuinely. I mean, that was our COVID response. Like, genuinely, you know, it's very easy with hindsight to come back and say, hey, you know, we did too much. We could have come out of that quicker. Well, actually, we didn't know what the hell we were doing. And I'd much rather we spend a little bit more time in lockdown, a little bit more time kind of making sure we're protecting our people than going, I lost friends and family in the UK. People, you know, friends, people I know are no longer with us because of COVID, right? People that I can't go and say hello to them. I can't speak to them anymore, right? Because the UK response was far, far different to our response. And it's great when you've got no one dies, you come back to it and go, oh, we did, you know, we just went too hard. Well, no, I don't think you can't, you know, it's the same with, you know, a weather event. You can't be overprotective when you do not know what is actually going to come, because you can't predict the weather.
No, like, to be honest, what it mainly happens, I believe also, it's a way of shifting focus, because currently, a lot of people disagree about what's the most valuable thing in life we need, or in this country or in other country. It's people. We are the entity that we give everything value around us. If we didn't invest in the people first, we cannot put a number. Like how I say, like, oh, I don't want to borrow, I don't want to move over budget because I help enough of people. But actually, no, you cannot put a price on people's life. You cannot put a price to say, like, oh, this budget is only for the emergency management. If it's overcross that budget, we need to stop that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Support or aspect of it.
You're right. I mean, without people, there's nothing to do. Like, you know,
like the house have no value. We give the house a value. We give gold value. We give petrol a value. Without the people, those all have zero value.
Yeah, exactly. Let's move on to the final part of the news, which is the continued craziness that is happening in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been on the planet 53 years now, coming up 54. I've never felt quite so scared as I do right now. And I don't mean scared. I wake up, you know, looking out the window, peering out the curtains. I'm just genuinely scared for the world as an entirety. We've got the in my mind, the world's largest aggressor, the US, starting a fight, then complaining that they don't want to stop the fight. Then, when they could have just stopped the fight themselves, then there was the pushback, the peace plan that came through from Iran, which created a ceasefire. But then Israel didn't want a piece of the ceasefire. And now we've got, just today, we've got announced that Israel are, you know, and this is a weird bit for me. You know, the Iran peace plan quite categorically said a stop to fighting in the Middle East. And then everyone went, yeah, but we don't mean Lebanon. You know, and I'm just looking at that kind of going, well, everyone else looking at those words would go, that includes everyone. Suddenly, finally, we've got a 10-day ceasefire in from Israel to Lebanon. And I just, I want everyone to hold hands and just be nice, right? I genuinely, that's my view. I know it's far more complicated than that, but it is a crisis, or a world crisis, of America's making in its almost in its entirety. In my view, from what I've seen and from what I understand, even the American guy that was talking about the cat with the guy that was in charge of the terrorist threat and stuff basically came out and said there was no imminent threat from Iran to the US before they dropped the first bomb. Right. Mm. Now, I'm not saying Iran is a fantastic state and I want to go and rush over there and live there, and you know, because they've done horrible things through the regime that they've got and they've killed people, and I don't approve of any of that whatsoever. But they were kind of minding their own business until someone else decided that they weren't when they were. And then everything that's happened in the last sort of 6 to 8 weeks, which is causing global roll up knock-on effects for everyone, has all become from the fact that the US said, I think they might do something, I'm gonna do something first. And it just feels very artificially created. And then now we've got this kind of really strange, you know, almost like the president of America standing up wanting thanks and praise for bringing a ceasefire. Well, you hadn't started fighting, mate. It's like the bully, you know, punches everyone and then kind of goes, and then tries to play peacemaker.
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense to me.
It's really unfortunate. However, to be honest, personally, who I grew up in the Middle East most of my life, this is not the first time it happened. This is, to be honest, on a regular basis, it happens. But the United States invaded Iraq in 2003 or even Afghanistan before that. Like all those aspects of happening, we lived it, we've seen it a lot. It's scary, yes, but unfortunately change will not happen. Like what we believe in a way that good and bad happen always exist at the same time. Without good, you cannot see bad, and without bad, you cannot see good. Without sadness, you're not going to feel happiness. So it needs to go along together. Unfortunately, it's when we try to justify those stuff by saying like, oh, I'm going to shoot you first because you might shoot me in the future. Like it does not apply. There is no logic behind that. It's a way to actually, I'm trying to cover my crime or shift focus on to something else to say like, oh, it's a potential danger in here. But this is the thing. Now we're talking that we need to think in that way more of building communities, not destroying communities in that aspect, because you cannot assume something bad will happen and I punish you for it. You cannot be punished for something you didn't commit yet.
Exactly. It's like a game. We're in the film Minority Report. Mm. You've seen that Tom Cruise film?
Yeah, the old one, really.
Yeah, it's a few years old. I'm just showing my age, Alan. It's a few years old, but it's where, you know, where they had this software that basically works out whether someone's going to commit a crime, and they create this Minority Report, and then they basically go and they go and arrest them for the crime that they were thinking that they're going. It's like living in a science fiction movie, because it is that, you know. You've got this. It seems. Almost kind of like clockwork that when America has personal, like home issues, they start a war. You know, when the polls aren't going well for the president of the time, and this is not just Trump, this is people before that, George W. Bush, the lot, Reagan, everyone. It's almost like if they start a war because everyone kind of rallies behind war and they kind of go, oh, yeah, we're going and doing good. This president's doing good across the world because they're sorting out a problem that was never a problem of theirs to sort out in the first place. And it feels like that right now because, like, Trump seems to be slowly losing control of everyone and everything, including perhaps his marbles, because he comes across as a little bit, like, unfortunately, like the – some of that faculty, some of his mental faculty seems to have disappeared a little bit. It seems like if they can, they start a war just to distract, which seems like the most extreme level of distraction that you can possibly ever bring to the world.
Definitely, and to be honest, specifically United States, on history which showed us, but in generally also most states in generally, like some governments, it's a way of distracting people. Like if I want to keep managing my people, I need an external enemy. So also like a joke way or future looking way, the only way you will see humans united on this earth is when we be fighted by aliens. We need an enemy to bring
We need an alien invasion, don't we? Because then we all, I like what you're saying there. And I agree, like you're joking, but if the aliens suddenly turn up, like we'd all be forgetting about the fact that like, you know,
our differences,
this country next to that country, or you stole a bit of my land, I stole a bit. They will be going like, we need to sort those aliens out, right? With another film we've seen that, Independence Day. Was that Tom Cruise? No, it was Will Smith. Will Smith. But anyway, I watch a lot of films, so I don't get out much, watch a lot of TV. But it is. You're kind of like, if that's the, that is it, isn't it? It's like, you know, it's almost like, so maybe we all of us should go to bed tonight and pray for an alien invasion. not a bad one. Like, yeah. not like a world annihilation kind
enough
of one.
Enough to unite us, suddenly.
Enough to kind of get everyone, I'd vote for you. that kind of thing. You know what I'm saying? There's nothing wrong with it. That's great. We're going to move on to talk about you. So I want to hear some more great ideas from you. But before we do that, mate, I'm going to get a quick word from our wonderful sponsor.
Dunedin, meet your new favourite bakery. Casa Valencia at 53 Musselburgh Rise is serving up freshly baked bread, pastries and gorgeous cakes. And if you haven't tried the ube donut yet, you are seriously missing out. Our signature purple yam donut and purple yam drink are the must-try combos your taste buds have been waiting for. Pair it all with a hot or cold drink, grab a cake for someone special and make your day a little sweeter. Casa Valencia, 53 Musselburgh Rise, Dunedin. Open Monday to Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. See you there.
Have you ever been at Casa Valencia?
No, not yet.
No. So they're literally by the LJ Hooker office, like which you obviously are familiar with. And they opened about 3 years ago. And like the first day they were open, I kind of walked down from the office and said, "Oh, hey, how you doing?" You know, and it's like, "Oh, he's got this fantastic like empanadas and little bit pastries and all these kinds." So I literally have lunch there every single day of the week. If I'm in the office, that's kind of my go to. And they have this fantastic thing which I've dubbed the crazy donut. Mm-hmm. Right, it's a donut, but it's got like fried chicken and Ooh. Spinach and like spicy mayo in there and cheese. So it's like a savory filling in a donut case. Shouldn't work, but it so does. It's like,
it sounds, it works. Like
it's, oh, mate,
a deep fried donut, nothing can beat that. A deep fried chicken, nothing can beat that.
Absolutely. Put the two together with a little bit, pretending you're getting your vegetables with some spinach, right? It's and then plenty of sauce. Genuinely, and the people are wonderful too. So if you do get a chance, go swing by there because they are. You'll go back. You'll make it. I can guarantee you, you'll go back because they're just fantastic people.
Definitely, will try them.
Good. I want to talk about you now. Okay, so cards on the table. We first met when I sold you your house, right? Yeah. So that's, you know, that's our side life. We've now brought our other life onto the radio, and I want to talk about your journey. So like, I obviously introduced you as a former refugee. Now, for a lot of people who are listening, that not won't necessarily mean
much,
particularly much, right? So perhaps you can just start by telling by giving us a little bit of your journey. So originally you're from
Syria.
Syria. So Damascus.
Yeah.
Okay. So perhaps you could start and tell us and give us the reasons, you know, that for come in and all those kind of bits and pieces, because I think that story is going to be an interesting one for people to hear too.
Yeah, I'll try to shorten the story as much as possible. You've got half an hour, mate.
If you just start talking, I'll just sit here and just wait. Like, it's up to you. Go on.
Yeah, so like, as I said, like, I'm originally from Damascus, Syria. It's my upbringing there, and I grew up until my early 20s in Syria, until 2012, where I was back then still at uni, doing almost my last year at uni. Where the Arabic Spring started happening in the Middle East. Unfortunately, Syria back at that time was been ruled by a dictatorship family. So Assad, the son, was ruling us, and before him was Assad, the father. I think Assad, the father, took the country in a military coup in 1970s, 69. And he inherited his son democratically in year 2000, and I grew up mainly in Bashar al-Assad. Like, when I was aware, I was mainly aware of Bashar al-Assad, the son, dictator. Syria, and to be honest, I was lucky. I grew up in a privileged family, considered one of the original founder families of the city Damascus, and you know, Damascus is an ancient city, so we exist in that region around 8,000 BC. And around that time, I was really engaging with the revolution. At the same time, even with a lot of my family members, was like, you're from the privileged people, you will lose that privilege if you start protesting or organizing such a things. However, we were like really what we call it hot-blooded young people, and we want to change. We want to see our country in a different way. We don't want to be living in the dictatorship only. The situation, unfortunately, our government was a brutal government, and especially when you stand up to them, they don't killing people is very easy for them. And we know now currently that there is over 1.5 million people get killed during Assad time. And during the last 14 years, only the revolution time, we call it.
So 1.5 million people have been killed in Syria.
And 900,000 missing. We don't know where they are missing.
Since 2000? Since 2000?
And 12. Since 2012.
2012. Okay, I'm with you. So that, yep. But of the previous, I'm guessing before that.
Oh, there was more
still,
well,
right? So this,
but it was more. It was not kind of on high scale war. Like I think in the '80s, in the '80s, when the Assad the father took over, he managed to also do a massive massacre in one state in northern Syria called Hama. And around that time, the number of dead, it was hard to report, but people say it's between 80,000 to 380,000 people got killed back then.
Okay, so again, just for anyone, me included. What would be the population, rough population of Syria?
In the last population count was in 2011, I think, and it was around 22 to 23 million people living in Syria. After the war, or during the war, around 6 to 8 million left the country as a refugee globally, like in Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey have the highest population in refugee camp. However, there is in Europe over like 2 million Syrian, and we spread all over the world anyway. With my personal journey, like as I said, like I was really investing in the part being part of the revolution, organizing protests, trying to also utilize some of my family privilege to be able to try to find out people kidnapped in government jails, release them with some like trying. It's a very corrupt country. You can pay money to get with anything you want in Syria. So I was really heavily investing in that. And then I start getting approached by people who are government people, like, and they start asking us in a direct, indirect way that if you're really a good Syrian citizen, you need to start arm your own group or be part of this armed group that you support Assad to take over. They call them the civil militias or something like that. I totally refused. It was like, no way, I'm not putting my people blood. And especially in those situations, really hard because it's more a civil war than a war. You know, you don't, sometimes the same guy you grew up with, you play with all your childhood, now you are an enemy supporting different groups. So I totally refuse those situation. And also, unfortunately, part of the chaos thing, I'm not sure it was a government-driven or non-government-driven, I survived 3 kidnapping attempts.
Wow.
I was lucky with most of them. It was like, those make me believe in God in some way.
Yeah.
Survived those stuff. And after that, my partner and mom, they was like, no way, you should not stay in the country. It's really dangerous for all guys to stay in Syria. So in late 2012, I left to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And the concept was I will leave to Kuala Lumpur with my partner, rent a house, establish a business operation office to my family business. And so my mom and dad can come. Leave the country. Unfortunately, after we moved to Kuala Lumpur, my dad got assassinated. After like 40 days, I left the country by the Syrian government. And as a government entity, they froze all our asset entities. Passport renewal was all tied to them. So I technically kind of got stuck in Kuala Lumpur with my partner. Lucky I had like rented a house, but I started some of the paper, rented an office space, but I couldn't continue. Fund the operation after that. And after my dad's death, well, you know, the issues of inheritance, names, property, asset, and those type of things. At the same stage as well in Syria, we have what we call a compulsory military service for boys. So if you are a boy, a Syrian male, your passport is not, used to be no more than 1 year valid.
Right.
And it was back information about Syrian passport. Oddly, it's the most weakest passport in the world, the most expensive. It's $800 renewal on every year for males.
For a passport?
Yeah.
Because they don't want you to leave?
No. So I was in Kuala Lumpur back then. I went to the embassy. I tried to tell them, like, I need to renew my passport. I only have like four months left. And they say like, oh, yep. Unfortunately, we can give you a paper to go to Damascus. We need to have a coffee with you before we be able to renew your passport. And it's a code that the intelligence agencies back in Syria want to meet with you and how likely that you're not going to leave the country after that. I totally said like, no, I'm not going back there. I don't need a passport. So I needed to reach out and engage with UNHCR. It's the High Official of Refugees Office.
Yeah.
I registered with them. It's a really long process of few years interviewing. Each interview is like 3 hours talking your life. It's interrogations about to make sure that if your claim is verified or not. Luckily, I had some documents that the government have like arrest warrants against me. And this was the style of the Syrian government as well, to avoid you coming back to ask for your properties or bank accounts or the something. They load you with so much crimes that you didn't commit, like, technically. So when I checked with a lawyer to check with my family in Syria, they say, like, oh, there is a court case against you that, like, drug trafficking, armed trafficking, all happened while I was outside the country. Like,
wow.
So it's a way for them to make sure that don't come back. Or even if you come back, you're dead or you're going to be in jail.
Yeah.
Lucky, I engaged with UNHCR. Within a few years, I was, like, just trying to live in Malaysia. Unfortunately, life was a little bit tough back then because Malaysian government will not recognize you as a legal resident. So you cannot really receive money or open a bank account or do any legal things, work legally or do anything. So I needed to be honest. Luckily, I met with a lot of people I know from Syria, like friends who are professionals, graphic designers, interior designers, engineers, and other background. And I have the skill of networking with people. So I managed to establish with the same paper I was doing. I did a company paper, but I registered it with a Malay guy name just to help with, you know, the legal aspect of it. But he was just to get from us a fixed salary to function under his name. And we did something called The Hive. And it's a network entity that if you want to start any business, you're a foreign investor, you don't know the local Kuala Lumpur country or Malaysia, we will help with that. We have from A to Z, from interior design to graphic design to logos to setting up staff, hiring, training. And we did quite a good number of businesses. Unfortunately, like, all the time we got paid, because sometimes if the guy who hired you to do the job knew that your illegal status, they can say, like, I'm not paying. And you can right. have no power of
taking your services and and everything you've offered, but then
found a way not to pay. With my partner and group of friends 5 years. And also back then we were, like, trying to engage with the UNHCR resettlement program. And we got interviewed by New Zealand government. We were really stoked, me and my partner, that New Zealand picked our file, because usually as a refugee back then, if, like, for example, any other country picked your file, you cannot reject a country that picked your file. You'll be out of the resettlement program.
Right. So you don't get to choose.
You don't choose which country you're going to. You don't choose which city you're going to be resettled in. You have no choice until you come to the city that. So the minute I stepped into the Naden, this way I have a choice of how I want to continue my life look like.
Right.
But prior to that was really hard to choose because you're a refugee, like in need situation. You cannot really pick and choose in some cases.
Right.
You need to be as resourceful as possible.
Yeah, and as flexible, obviously, as possible.
I think the journey itself will toughen your ego in a way, because unfortunately, I think the biggest challenge, and maybe personally for me, I came from a privileged family. I never really needed money. But luckily, my father was really into work. So I started engaging with businesses since I was 16. Any summer school, I have to be getting a role either at my dad's company or working somewhere else. I have to learn a skill. And that actually helped me with my journey, because sometimes when you're traveling as a refugee, no one really acknowledges your degrees.
Okay.
So my degrees are just to put on the wall. Even now I moved to New Zealand, my degree is not recognized in New Zealand because I need to redo studies here, but the skills is there.
Yeah. So what degrees do you have?
I have what I consider, like, I think equal to level 5 management degree. Yep. And also I have bachelor in, we call it MBA, but it's more, it was like specific program to focusing on economical, political and social engineering, part of the dictatorship there.
Okay. So I mean, obviously I used to live a lot closer to Syria than I do right now. But I genuinely don't know a lot about that particular area.
It's a very ancient country. Like the Syria, the border that we know, it's very new. It's related to the European colonization in the Middle East. So, like, after World War One situation,
yeah.
The current establishment. Anciently, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Jordan all looked at it as Levant. We are all one country. We are different regions within this country. So we consider all of each other same ethnic groups. We are Levantian.
Right.
It's really hard because we don't have the concept of ethnicity as well. In our culture, we consider all humans same ethnicities. We have different bloodlines. We have different grandpas. But right. also, some grandpa will meet us all.
Okay.
On it. So I'm a mix of Arab and Syriac bloods in me. So as I said, like, part of my family is Syriac origin, and that was the Aramic or the indigenous, one of the indigenous group of Syria, because even Arab is an indigenous group of Syria. So it's very multicultural, I will say, multi-religions. There are so many different religions going, main three Abrahamic religions, but with all their branches as well. So, for example, last weekend we celebrated the Eastern Church Easter, and the before we were celebrating the Western Easter. So a different church. So we do also have public holidays with all religious holidays.
Right. Okay. So is your mum still there?
My mom is in Istanbul, Turkey currently. I have a younger brother in Germany, in Hamburg, Germany with his family. And I have half siblings between Qatar and Turkey. So technically my family spread on three continents currently.
Wow. And that's not through, I'm assuming that's not through choice necessarily.
No, unfortunately it's life.
Yeah, that is the refugee kind of journey that you've gone through. Because I mean, obviously, I've come to New Zealand, but that was my choice. I chose to leave my mum behind, right? Not have to worry about her because my brothers are looking after her. I've got brothers back in the UK. I've got family back in the UK.
It's a really tricky situation. As there is no choice for you at all. So even when I said that I left Syria, and sometimes now when I want to look at it, I left all my personal stuff. I remember the day I left with my partner to Kuala Lumpur, I was like, I'm coming back in like a month or two times. So all the things that it means something, it might have no value, no physical value, but have a lot of sentimental values, or photo albums of my childhood. So I have few photos of my childhood currently because someone sent it to you or someone have it. Everything personal to you, you left it because you'd be like, I'm coming back. It was not a plan to leave at all, but suddenly you leave or you've been forced to leave and you cannot come back. Some of our properties got destroyed during the war. Some of the properties still there. It's really a weird thing now. When I see also now the city, most of the people I know, I grew up with, they are no longer there. So,
right. Excuse me. Frog in my throat. I do apologize. So, is Syria the same now? Has it changed since you left?
Definitely. But at this, what happened when you live under the dictatorship? Assad, to be honest, froze them in time and sometime. So, I will say Syria, people knowing what's going on, but society is frozen in time since 2014, 2012. They are not in currently 2026, but luckily in 2024, one of the opposition group who was controlling northern Syria managed to take over Assad government in 8th of December. We call it now the day of the revolution success, where we get freed of Assad. We have currently a current government who's ruling. They are trying to change the country to a different perspective. It's very early stages after 14 years of destruction. There is zero infrastructure, zero economic situation. It's really hard to expect in 1 year or 1.5 year time for them to be done. I don't think anyone is like, I'm not fully with them, I'm not fully against them, and they need time to see. So I cannot really assess. I will assess the situation economically is really bad because we know if we are here affected badly economically, imagine a country where there are zero infrastructures going on. But at the same time, like as a human, I believe that we are adaptable and we are survivable. Like we can survive in tough situation. We can adapt to the tough situation. It's gonna like if I cannot really. I think it needs at least 5 to 10 years time before we say that now we have some infrastructure. We can go back to maybe a proper election or proper establishing a like proper parliament, because currently there is no infrastructure for anything to do such a thing like that. Like barely there is electricity and barely there is some of that.
Wow. I've got a couple of questions for you, but before we get on to that, I want to get another quick word from our wonderful sponsor.
Yeah.
Dunedin, meet your new favourite bakery. Casa Valencia at 53 Musselburgh Rise is serving up freshly baked bread, pastries and gorgeous cakes. And if you haven't tried the ube donut yet, you are seriously missing out. Our signature purple yam donut and purple yam drink are the must-try combos your taste buds have been waiting for. Pair it all with a hot or cold drink, grab a cake for someone special and make your day a little sweeter. Casa Valencia, 53 Musselburgh Rise, Dunedin. Open Monday to Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. See you there.
I get the feeling that people listening, when if they don't know much about the refugee thing and the refugee journey, I get the feeling that most people would not fully understand or even have the kind of bandwidth to understand what being a refugee actually really means, right? Because I just, again, you know, I spend too much time on social media, but I see, you know, you mentioned refugees. The media love kind of alluding the fact that someone who comes to this country has done something that's not very nice, used to be a refugee, right? Or, you know, and, or, you know, just like, and it drives me mad because they don't talk about those people, other people doing exactly the same things in the same manner. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, there will be I genuinely think there will be a view that refugee simply means that you basically said to someone, I feel like I'm in danger. I'm just going to go and live wherever I want in the world and you know, feed off that, right? Completely wrong, right? Genuinely completely wrong, right? You've explained a story and many people that would on that refugee journey would have similar stories to tell. You've described a journey to me that is filled with trauma, survived three kidnappings, right? Accused of, you know, not accused of, but just basically false crimes made up about you so that you can't return to the place that you have come from. And a family that has literally been cast across the world because of the fact that, you know, if I want to right now, I can go back and live with anyone in my family, right? I can do that. There's nothing stopping me. I don't think people have any kind of comprehension, like real comprehension. And to be fair, whilst I know a little bit about refugees, I can't say that I had the same level of comprehension to you sitting there and actually explaining this to me. What can we say to those people? Because actually, it feels like something that is completely misunderstood at so many levels. Because the stories that we end up getting in our part of the world is the bit where that person that's gone through that huge life trauma and all those massive things does something criminal in this country, therefore it kind of becomes, we were talking about minorities at the beginning, it kind of becomes this, you know, they're a bad minority. Am I making sense?
I understand that. It's unfortunately is, but also for us all, it's away from refugee or other things. We should not generalize punishment and specific like the praising. So if someone did something good, you hear, unfortunately, in some media articles, newspaper, be like, oh, a New Zealander or someone, a citizen have did something good.
Yep.
If it's something bad, they will specify, be like, you will hear like a former refugee from Syria have done blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, because they want to generate a different
narrative about it. It's really tricky because like, if you are a Syrian, as long as you're human, you could be good, you could be bad, you could take bad choice as well. Because to be honest, also, I don't try to judge people from the lowest point. I need to judge you from your average. We all do mistakes. We all do something. We all might act sometimes on that anger moment that we do bad things for us. We should not be judged from that moment. I should judge your average.
Yep. I hear you. I love the theory of it
and the concept of that. So at the same time, we might have bad people as a refugee. Not all refugees are angels. Not all refugees, you know, like we are humans in the end. We should just not look at it as, oh, because you're assassinated. Because like, let's be honest, all those stuff, you never choose to be a refugee. Like there is no pathways to work to become a refugee unless a government decided to rebel against people or against a minority group. You don't choose where you came from. Like, I didn't choose to be birthed in Syria. So all the attachment they add to you, it's something as a human you have not chose, you know? So we should not be judged on those stuff. We could have bad people. We could have non-bad people. But let's be thinking the biggest. A lot of former refugees, similar to migrants, when they come, even us as Kiwis, when we go travel to touristy to another country, we might do a culture mistake or we break a law in some country. If you go to Singapore and have a gum, you're breaking the law, you know, in situations like that. While in New Zealand, gum is not, most of the world, gum is not illegal.
Right. You're talking about chewing gum?
Yeah. Each country, yeah.
So, hang on, are you telling me that in Singapore?
Chewing gum is illegal.
Wow.
You can get, I think, by prescription only.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's, I don't, I don't come on this radio show to learn stuff, mate, but today you taught me something, you know, like genuinely, that's wow.
Each country, they have their own laws.
They have their own rules, right, absolutely.
But I'm not saying it's bad law, it works for them. I don't know what's their situation exactly.
That's their law, right?
Exactly, so that's why and let's remember that most of the refugees, they didn't choose to come to New Zealand, so they didn't prepare themselves culturally, understand, they don't have the language. So when they might come, also they are still in the survival mode situation.
Of course.
When you are... And that's why we say, like, when you are unfortunate, and this is the great thing about humans, when something wants to break you, you're unbreakable. Your brain shelters you from all the trauma. You don't feel the trauma. You don't feel, like, I came across one day in Syria, I buried 248 of my childhood friends, people I used to play soccer in the neighborhood with, because the government decided to come to the neighborhood and sweep it all. I didn't feel it back then. I felt it 12 years later. Because as long as you're in the survival mode, your brain wants you to protect you, wants to keep you alive. It enhances all your senses. It's not only enhances your senses, it makes you feel a lot of maybe bigger doses of dopamine. So like if you manage to make ends meet for a week, you manage to survive, to receive money from overseas because you're illegally going to receive money in Malaysia. It translated in your brain to extreme win. Like the amount of dopamine, serotonin could be really high, pumping in your brain. When you come to New Zealand, it's great. You will live, as we call it now, is also in the resettlement spaces, the honeymoon period.
Right.
You're coming to a country you might know much about, you might not know much, but your brain is planning unrealistic expectation because you came from a country that you consider really bad to a host country also that it's not, they didn't treat you fairly, to a country that you think that you put over expectation on New Zealand. But in the end, New Zealand is reality. You come here, there is, like personally, when I come to New Zealand, I was shocked by the quality of the houses and the prices and the quality of the medical system and a little bit education system. In Syria, we have really bad everything corrupt, but we have one of the best medical system, I think, previously. You go directly to specialist. Most of it is free. You don't need referrals. We don't have a GP concept at all. So if I go to, for example, a doctor by telling me like, no, your thing, you need to see heart specialist.
Right.
And something else, you go. And the time you need to be seen is just to walk into the clinic.
Right, and it's done.
You don't have an appointment. You don't need much stuff unless there is a surgery. You need those type of things. At the same time, study-wise, we have free education from elementary school to uni. So even uni is fully free, the government. We have private unis as well, but they function in a different way. So where you do, before coming to New Zealand, I expected that New Zealand medical system would be way ahead of Syria.
Right.
And houses would be way more modern and developed than Syria. But then you realize like, oh, my house, family house, it was like fully central heating, fully insulated. Our external walls is 40 centimeter thick, internal walls 20 centimeter thick.
Yeah.
Real well designed. And so we say like, you don't need to renovate a house in Syria unless once every 70 years.
Right. Wow.
It's built to last
once every seven months almost in New Zealand.
It's quality. Like we don't have much earthquakes. We had, but it's more so we built differently than here.
Of course.
But at the same time, when you tell someone in Syria that I'm gonna buy a house that could be $500,000, people there they will interpret that you're living in a mansion with maybe multiple Ferraris outside.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
no one will think that it's normal quality is house.
We're gonna run out of time. We haven't quite run out of time yet, but I just want to pause for a very second and acknowledge the fact that you buried 250 of your friends. Right, that to me is something that I don't think anyone that's listening today will have any comprehension of whatsoever. How old are you, fella?
I'm 35 years old.
35 years old, right? 35 years old. I'm almost twice your age. My maths a bit off. But I don't think anyone can kind of comprehend that, and I didn't want to rush past it without kind of giving it a little bit of a moment, because that would have, in my mind now, that would have destroyed me as a human being there and then, right? And here you are in front of me as a wonderful young human being, and you know, speaking about that trauma. And coming across with positivity and stuff, and I just want to acknowledge how wonderful that is to me. What are you doing now? You've literally got a minute. What are you doing now in New Zealand? What's on the cards for Alan?
Like since 2019, I'm working with the New Zealand Red Cross in resettlement of the refugees population. I'm currently the team lead for Dunedin.
Right.
I work with Kelly, who she came in the show with you here before. We support former refugees' families to resettlement in New Zealand and help I help them in the journey I did in myself to try to pass that. And also I engage with mainstream agencies, do some trainings and workshops on best practice with former refugees and best practice in generally.
So you come through the refugee process and you give them back to that refugee
hopefully
process.
And I hope that one day I'll be able to give back also to the wider community, because I still feel that Dunedin is my home now, and I don't think I would leave somewhere else.
No, do you not want to go back to Syria?
Go to visit, definitely. I want to visit there, but now I think this is my home.
And that is absolutely the perfect way to finish the show. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing that with me. It's been fantastic. Fantastic to hear, if that makes sense, but fantastic to hear at the same time. You just sit there while I round out the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, that's a wrap for this week. Thank you for tuning in. I've been Richard Knights, and you've all been wonderful. Remember, if you're looking for a robust, respectful adult debate about all things local and further afield, and a welcoming online community that doesn't take itself too seriously, come and find What's News Dunedin on Facebook and join our fun. On next week's show, we'll be talking to Professor Charles Brennan, who's the Pro Vice-Chancellor of the Science Division at the University of Otago, and we look forward to seeing you next Friday at 12 on ORFM. And if you want to listen to the show again, or simply share it with your friends, you can find the podcast at oar.org.nz, or even on Spotify, YouTube, or your favourite podcast provider.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.